Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. 40 acres and a mule. Following the Civil War, that was a promise from the federal government to formerly enslaved African Americans. It was a promise designed to help them get a toehold into their new reality of freedom, a promise to, for the first time, participate in the economy and to build their own personal economies. And for many, it was a promise quickly denied. Some of the land involved can be found today in gated, majority white communities where the value is in the millions of dollars. It's the subject of an investigation by the Center for Public Integrity in collaboration with Mother Jones Magazine and the public radio program Reveal. Here's how they put it.
After the Civil War, the federal government actually gave formerly enslaved people land, 40 acres, and then took it back.
Can you imagine? Can you imagine? I can't.
They had it and then they just pulled it the rug from under them, so to speak.
This was a betrayal.
Samuel Miller, 40 acres on Edisto.
Fergus Wilson, 40 acres on Sapelo Island.
Primus Morrison, 40 acres on Edisto.
Lucy Crosby.
So far, we found more than 1,200 people who got land and had it taken away. We found some of their descendants.
Great-grandfather, that's my great-grandfather. I had to tell somebody.
And we met people who own that land today.
My question is, where do we go from here? Do they want it back?
I don't know. I wish I had an answer to that. I'm not happy with where this world is or where this country is right now.
That's why we're trying to understand what do we think we should do to try to reckon with that past.
40 acres and a lie.
As a program note, WFAE airs Reveal episodes on Sundays and will be airing the three episodes devoted to this story in this time slot for 3 days next month. But on this day, the day before Juneteenth, we dig a little deeper through a conversation with two of the reporters who brought this to light. Alexia Fernandez-Campbell is senior investigative reporter, most recently at the Center for Public Integrity in Washington, where she covered labor and inequality. Thank you for joining us. Good morning.
Good morning.
April Simpson is a senior reporter covering racial equity, most recently also at the Center for Public Integrity. She is based in Dallas, Texas. April, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And we also have one of the descendants of formerly enslaved people who had the promise of land denied. Ruth Wilson is with us from her home in Wake Forest. Thank you for being here as well, Ruth. Good morning.
Good morning.
Alexia, I'm start with you. And as we'll discuss, this story was a surprise to a lot of people, a lot of the descendants of formerly enslaved people. And it was a surprise to many of the people who are living and who own that land that was given to those people originally today. So how did the Center for Public Integrity uncover it? How did Mother Jones and the radio program Reveal become involved in all of this?
Yeah, it's a really interesting story because April and I were on a team and we were researching a different story. It was related to Black land loss, but it wasn't related to 40 acres. And so I was trying to find land records to find historic Black settlements. And someone I spoke to said, hey, you know what? I think there might be land records in the Freedmen's Bureau documents, which I didn't know what the Freedmen's Bureau was, but it was an agency from Reconstruction era that helped the freedmen adjust to society to integrate them in the South. So there are all these records that were just recently put online, and the National Archives keeps these records. So I was looking through, I was deep in the digital archives, and I saw actually the first title that I looked at closely was Ruth's great-great-great-grandfather. And it said Fergus Wilson, 40 acres, Sapelo Island, Georgia. And it was like this, it caught my attention because it was an image and it looked kind of like it was like the ink was smudged. It looked like it had been folded a million times. Like the edges were torn and worn. I'm like, what am I looking at? And it said under the authority of Sherman Special Order 15, which I didn't realize what it was. But then I started looking through all the titles in this folder And they all said like four, most of them said 40 acres. Some said 30 acres, 20 acres. And then I realized after doing some research, this was the 40 acres. Sherman's special order was 40 acres. And I'm like, what? People got land titles? That's not what my understanding was. So, you know, I took it back to the team and we realized this is the beginning of an interesting story.
She keeps talking, April, about 40 acres. I've always heard 40 acres and a mule. Evidently, the mule was never part of it, but somehow it got tagged on. But most of us, at least I had heard of this program from, I guess, high school history class, somewhere in the hinterlands of my mind. But give us a refresher. Why was it started? What was it intended to do? April.
Yes. So the program was intended to give Black people a start, right? People are fresh out of slavery. They literally have nothing, you know, no land, nothing to start building wealth and build a life. So the land was a means for true independence. You know, land has been something that this country has prided itself on being a landowner. And I think today, you know, a lot of the leaders in our community are also landowners. So it was an ability to give Black people, give former slaves a start, something that they could build off of, but obviously it didn't last for very long.
Yeah, that was the surprising thing to me, because I'd heard about it in history class, as I said, 40 acres and a mule, whether the mule was there or not, but I never heard that it ended, and it ended so very quickly. I think it was a year and a half after this all began to begin. They rescinded all the offers, took back the land in some cases. Why did that happen, and how has that part of our history been kind of obscured by the mists of time? Alexia, or April, either one of you.
April, you want to go ahead and answer that one?
Sure. So it got a bit complicated. I mean, there were some legal disagreements about whether the government could actually seize this land and distribute it. So that was one of the reasons that the program didn't work out. But there also just wasn't the same commitment to it over time. Once President Lincoln was assassinated, just a month after 40 acres went into effect, Andrew Johnson was not committed to seeing this program through. He rescinds Sherman's order, and there was some pushback. There were military generals like Howard and Saxton who really wanted to see this program through. And, you know, they are on the ground and they're still moving forward with the 40 acres program and still distributing land. And there's this push and pull between, you know, Johnson and the generals. But over time, Johnson basically forced their hand and the land was given back to the former plantation owners.
And I want to talk more about Andrew Johnson's involvement in this a little bit later on. Alexia, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, it's really amazing. And when we were looking at the Freedmen's Bureau records, we found, because, you know, Andrew Johnson was pardoning people all over the South, giving them their land back. But the Freedmen's Bureau is like basically ignoring that and saying it didn't apply to the 40 acres land. So for the long, like what April was saying, like for the longest time, they resisted. They're like, no. His orders that, you know, revoking or like pardoning people, restoring their lands, it doesn't apply here because we're giving these land titles and we already told everyone here that this was their land. But we would see letters in the Freedmen's Bureau records of like the white landowners returning and saying, please restore my land. I already like, you know, sought a pardon from the president. I, you know, gave my allegiance to the Union. I need to get back to harvest. The season upon us. This is embarrassing. So there are all these letters from the white landowners begging to get their land back, and they ended up getting it.
What's also interesting about this is that this idea of giving land to formerly enslaved people did not come as a result initially of a law from Congress. It did not come in the form of an executive order from President Lincoln, as is customary. The idea came from Union General William Tecumseh Sherman, who was famous, of course, for his trek through the South and burning Atlanta, etc. He issued an edict called Special Field Order Number 15. In large swaths of South Carolina, Georgia, and Florida for formerly enslaved people to live and work and govern themselves. And in the articles in Mother Jones, you write, April, it became this nation's most famous attempt to provide some form of reparations for American slavery. But it wasn't just a matter of a promise or even allowing these people to work on the land, the government issued titles, as Alexia brought out, which in any other situation would be firm proof that you own that land, you have the right to occupy it and use it as you see fit. They issued hundreds of titles to specific plots of land ranging from 4 to 40 acres. And the records, as Alexia pointed out a moment ago, exist. Is the Center for Public Integrity the first organization to comb through these records, or merely the first to report on it, April?
We're certainly not the first to comb through it or report on it, but we are the first to collect them and independently confirm that more than 1,200 formerly enslaved people received one of these titles. And as far as we know, it is the most detailed accounting to date of how many Black Americans received land.
So these titles, Alexi, do they actually, all of them actually exist? Is that why you can put a 1,200 number on this, because you have seen these titles?
I'm glad you asked that, because not all of them came from the physical titles. There are about 100, we found out about 150 titles, like copies of the titles, like Ruth's ancestor. And then the others, I found two registers, and then another colleague found more registers, but it's basically the Freedmen's Bureau agencies, a log. They would create logs saying, today I issued 30 acres to so-and-so on this plantation on this date. And so they would record every land title they give out. Because you can imagine many of them kept their land titles, right? They didn't give them back to the government. So even if it didn't mean anything after a while, it had no value, they kept them. So most of the names we got from those registers, and some of them, and not clearly, like they overlapped with the, you know, the land titles corresponded with a name on the register.
So Union General Sherman took it upon himself to issue this field order number 15, which put this into motion. What gave him the authority to do that? Did he have Lincoln's permission? Did he have to consult with Lincoln? Did he just do it on his own? How did that work?
It was really interesting, right? April may know some more that you can add. But so basically the Secretary of War, when Sherman captured Savannah, the Secretary of War said, go meet with the Black leaders in Savannah, ask them what they need, because thousands of freed people were following Sherman's troops to Savannah. And they were all now in Savannah, and no one knew, okay, what, they're waiting for something. So he met with the Black ministers in Savannah, and they said, and he's like, basically, what do you want? So the Secretary of War, he had the authority from him. I'm sure he couldn't do that without Lincoln's approval. And so they said, we want land. We want to be left alone. We need land to be able to support ourselves so that you don't have to take care of us. And that's what led to the order. But it was a military order, right? So it was always understood that it needed Congress's approval. And even says, this is your land, subject to approval from, I don't know if it says Congress or, but it says for the proper authorities. So Congress needed to ratify it to make these land titles permanent. And there was always this idea, of course it was going to happen. I mean, there were Freedmen's Bureau agents literally meeting with free people and saying, this land is yours, you deserve it. And with, cause so everyone was like so clear that this was, Congress was going to pass it, Lincoln was going to sign it, but then, you know, he was assassinated and that changed everything.
So this was 1865. The Civil War is ending or has ended in for all intents and purposes, and the South, which had broken away, as everybody knows, from the Union, was kind of still enemy territory for a lot. And I guess there were people on both sides. People on the Union side wanted to punish people in the South for seceding. Was this considered punishment or simply fairness? Very quickly, because I have 20 seconds.
April, what do you think?
I don't think it was considered punishment. I think it was considered an opportunity to give formerly enslaved people a start.
April Simpson and Alexia Fernandez-Campbell worked on this story, this series of stories for Mother Jones and for the radio program Revealed. They're with us this morning along with Ruth Wilson, a descendant of a formerly enslaved person who was part of this, and we'll continue in a moment. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Alexandra Fernandez-Campbell and April Simpson are both reporters who worked with the Center for Public Integrity on a series of reports on the 40 acres promise that the federal government made to formerly enslaved people in the aftermath of the Civil War back in 1865. It's also been written up in Mother Jones magazine, and also is part of a three-part series on the Reveal public radio program, which we air here on Sundays. The first episode in this series aired 2 days ago. The second episode will air this coming Sunday, and the three episodes together will be part of a special preemption of this program for 3 days in July. How did General Sherman, who issued these field orders that set all this in motion, Alexia, how did he choose the plots of land that he was deeding essentially to these formerly enslaved individuals?
So I know that they were specifically going to redistribute seized land that were land that was abandoned because people had to evacuate from Confederate sympathizers. People who fought in the Confederacy were loyal to the Confederacy, because I know not every single plantation there on the coast was included. I know that there was in the Ogeechee area, there was a basically, you know, there were a few plantation owners who sided with the Union. And there it's interesting because I noticed their plantations weren't part of the program. I mean, yeah, weren't included in the land that was redistributed. So I think the main thing, and correct me if I'm wrong, April, was that it was land that was seized from the Confederates and was going to be redistributed.
And this land is primarily in Florida, Georgia, and South Carolina. What happened to Mississippi and Alabama and states like that? Why were they excluded from this? Was it simply because Sherman wasn't there?
I don't know. I haven't seen anything. Have you, April? I think it was because he was there with so many people and they're like, well, the land is here. Let's give them the closest land so they don't have to travel. But that's speculating. I haven't seen anything about why that land specifically.
And for those of us who have heard of this program in the past, this General Sherman's program, we've always heard of it as 40 acres and a mule. That was the promise. The mule was never part of this. So how did the mule get included in the historical record here that we always think about?
I honestly do not know. I do know it could be because I know that the Union Army had a ton of mules left over and they were giving some of them to freedmen, but it wasn't actually part of like the promise. It's just something that they're like, okay, we don't know what to do with all these mules. And some people did get mules, and maybe that's why it became remembered that way. I'm not sure.
So April, these titles were distributed by General Sherman. The Congress, and we'll talk about this, the Congress later tried to codify this by voting it into law, etc. But shortly, about a year and a half after it began, many of these titles, if not all of them, were rescinded. What happened to the people who took the land because they thought they owned it because they were holding a title in their pocket? What happened to those folks?
Yeah, well, some of them ended up working on the very plantations that they got titles to, or even where they were enslaved. The plantation that I reported on in South Carolina, for example, the owner received a pardon. He came back. He did employ some of those folks, and others moved on. They moved on to other places where there were more opportunities for them. And then some actually were able to acquire land, whether they're in their communities or elsewhere.
And I believe the number that you've come up with is around 1,250 people that you know of. Could there be more that we simply don't know of?
Yeah, I believe there can. We have a tool that is combing a lot of these records and using artificial intelligence to do so. So there's still a lot to be discovered.
So Lincoln was on board with this. I think the Congress in 1865 was on board with this. They passed a law, but then Lincoln was, they tried to pass a law. Lincoln was assassinated. Andrew Johnson, the president who followed Lincoln, refused to sign it. He vetoed it. It came back to Congress. They passed a weaker version of it as a result of that. Andrew Johnson was an avowed white supremacist who found it politically expedient to use executive orders, as you've mentioned, to pardon former Confederate slave owners and restore their ownership rights to their property. He also vetoed that law. When this happened and the land was taken away from African Americans, or when some never received what was promised them, what was their reaction at the time? Do we know?
Well, we know at least when in Georgia, which was the area I was focusing on, there was one area where people revolted. when this former slave owners were trying to come back in the Ogeechee area where there were rice plantations near Savannah, there was a militia. They had created a militia. All the formerly enslaved who got land titles, they had their 40 acres, and they created a militia to protect themselves because there was still violence, especially on the mainland and not the sea islands. There was a lot of white violence, people who were not happy with how things turned out. And so they had this militia, the Ogeechee Home Guard. They were armed. They got their weapons from the federal government to protect themselves. But then suddenly when they realized they're losing their land, they just revolted. And they had to, April, you know the details about them. They had to call the army in to quell the revolt. What exactly happened? I know some people went to jail.
Yeah, there was a lot of violence. I know in South Carolina, for example, General Saxton came and he shared the news that the land was going to be rescinded at the Trinity Church in Edisto. And there was anger and there was a lot of sorrow. You know, people just couldn't believe that they had been so loyal and they had really invested so much in the land and it was going to be taken away and given to their former enslavers. And that was kind of a critical turning point.
How were they able to accomplish this? It seems to me that if the federal government allows generals in the field to issue orders, and one of those orders is that this is now your property and here's the title to the land, what legal leg did they have to stand on to rescind that?
So, you know, as we talked about, we still needed Congress to act. But there was also this distinction between land that was abandoned or evacuated and whether this land could legally be seized in the first place. So because that was a legal loophole and because there were people, essentially lobbyists like William Trescott working on behalf of South Carolina and essentially a lot of those plantation owners, there was, you know, that kind of those kinds of actions happening. And people in Andrew Johnson's year to rescind the program.
What you and there I don't know how many people worked on this story. I know at least three of you did, but what you did seems to me to be gargantuan because you had to comb through. I read it was 1.8 million records to uncover this, to identify 1,250 formerly enslaved men and women who received titles of land in Georgia, South Carolina, and Florida. That seems nearly impossible. How did you do it?
Yeah, it was overwhelming at moments. Like we thought, like if someone hadn't said you have to finish this now by Juneteenth, like we would like still be working on it because we thought it was just there's just so much. We had to finally be like, okay, we're going to get out what we have, which is already a lot. But one of our colleagues, Pratik Rabala, the way we were able to look through those all 1.8 million Freedmen's Bureau records was not like we were reading them. First of all, they're impossible to read. But he created an algorithm, which was, we showed, essentially it was an algorithm that said, he said, trained it to say, like, look through all the Freedmen's Bureau records for another document that looks like this land title. So basically facial recognition, because it can't read that handwriting. The computer, they can't read that old handwriting. So with facial recognition, looked through all those 1.8 million records and found more land titles. And all the same thing with the register with the names. He said, look for more documents that look like this. And that's how it combed through all 1.8 million and turned up more registers with more names. And it could be that there are some registers that don't look like that, that have even more names. We just haven't seen them because they don't have the same format or something. So that's how we were able to do it, thank goodness.
And it wasn't just the titles that you uncovered. You've been able to trace to the descendants of these people. Because Congress passed the Freedmen's Bureau Preservation Act in 2000, and because the Mormon Church began to digitize images of records from the Reconstruction era of the 1860s through its genealogy platform called Family Search, would it be accurate to say that that we can trace many of those who were given title to land only to have it taken away to people alive today? How many people have you been able to do that with?
We identified 41 people alive today who were descendants. And, you know, I'm sure people who are, you know, professionals, and we did have the help of a professional, but I'm sure there are more out there that could be, you know, identified. We just didn't have the bandwidth. We had to stop at some point.
Ruth Wilson is with us. She is one of those descendants of a formerly enslaved, people, I should say, because I'm sure it's not just one person in the family line here. You are a descendant. How did the Center for Public Integrity, Ruth, find you?
Through Ancestry, strangely enough. I joined Ancestry after everyone in my Wilson family had passed. I'm an only child and only grandchild, and I just felt a need to know more. And she found me through Fergus Wilson. I built my family tree, and I think that's how she found me.
Ancestry, yeah. Being Ancestry.com, the website that we see mm-hmm. the commercials for on television. So this was a good move for you, joining this website.
Yes, I didn't know enough. My grandfather Wilson, Hercules Wilson Jr., was probably one of my favorite people in life. And he had stories. And I just wanted to know more about his family because we were in North Carolina and he came from Georgia. And I never really made that Georgia connection.
So would it be safe to say then, Ruth, that you knew nothing about your family's connection to this 40 acres field order?
Nothing at all.
Now that you do know, where was that property that was deeded to one of your ancestors? Do you know?
Yeah, I had heard of Sapelo Island all my life, but never about 40 acres and a mule. It was something else, a little joke in the family about Sapelo. Never heard that they own property there.
What do you know about the people who own property there? Do you know anything about your ancestors? Because it was a long time ago and records are sketchy, I'm sure.
Records are sketchy. I heard the name Fergus. Mm-hmm. But Fergus, my great-great-grandfather had a son named Fergus. No, take that back. Had a grandson named Fergus who was my grandfather's brother. So I had heard the name Fergus as my grandfather talked about his brother. I did not even realize that my grandfather was a junior until I went to Ancestry. But I had been told and found that he served in the Hercules Wilson Sr. served in the Georgia legislature during Reconstruction.
We heard in the opening to this program a little compilation of sound from the actual series that's being aired as part of the Reveal public radio program. And we heard some of the reaction of people who have been contacted by the Center for Public Integrity reporters that we're talking to today and who were connected to this. Let me play that moment once again.
They had it and then they just pulled the rug from under them, so to speak.
That's my great-grandfather. I had to tell somebody.
So two kind of different reactions to being told that they had ancestors who had been part of all of this. What was yours, Ruth, when you found out?
What's new? I am not surprised. This is a story that I have heard over and over again. So, yeah.
But how did it make you feel? I mean, what emotions, if any, did you experience?
Here we go again. I mean, it's the same ride that over the years my family has been on, not with the taking away of land, but not being provided opportunities or being treated unfairly. And I think, you know, the first time I heard it, I can't really say what I was thinking on air. But,
please.
Yeah. But, you know, it's the same old story. We try to build a life and it's taken away from us. We are denied generational wealth. We are denied opportunities. And another sense I had was of pride, because in all of that, we survived and are surviving and thriving in spite of it.
In the course of your reporting on this, Alexia, you interviewed some of the descendants of these folks, some of which we just heard from on that piece of tape. But for more than that, you were bringing this news to their attention. Many of the people you spoke to had no idea that this was part of their family history. They didn't know about it. One of the people was Linda Brown, one of the few black people who lives in The Landings, which is a mostly white gated community on Skidaway Island, I think it's in Georgia, which was part of the land given by this field order to formerly enslaved people, freed people, under this 40 acres program. Here's a portion of that conversation.
So here I'm showing you two different land titles of two freedmen who got 40 acres on the plantation that is where your house is located.
So we didn't know that there were paperwork involved in that. It was paperwork involved in it. It was just sort of spoken from the field. That was how we perceived it, just spoken from the field. So never did we think that anything beyond that happened. And my brother, who was a captain in the Army, he understood field orders, and then he was an attorney. He didn't even know it.
Is it surprising to you to see that there were these actual land titles given?
Absolutely. It gives you, you could feel chills to know that they had it and then they just pulled it, the rug from under them, so to speak.
Yeah.
This is breaking news, really, for some, and it's to me.
This was breaking news, she said. Beyond that, Alexia, what was her reaction?
Yeah, Linda was amazing because she was like one of the only black people who lives in The Landings, and she had been looking for a house that was not on a plantation, And she later on in the show says, I can't believe I thought I was going to buy a home that wasn't formerly a plantation in Georgia. She's like, that was crazy to think. But so her, she said it just totally changed the way she saw her community. Because she even said, like, do they want this land back? Do their descendants want this land back? So she was pretty shocking for her.
We're going to talk about that aspect of all these discoveries, because it would seem to me that some people might want that land back, and why not? We'll come back to that and more in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about discoveries made by the Center for Public Integrity about the 40 Acres and a Mule program that was established by General Tecumseh Sherman in 1865 at the end of the Civil War, which resulted in a lot of freed, enslaved people getting titles to land, particularly in Georgia, South Carolina, and Florida, only to have those titles taken away from them about a year, year and a half later. Alexandria Fernandez Campbell and April Simpson are two of the reporters that worked on that story. They're with us today. It's part of the Reveal radio series, which you can hear here, the second episode of that series on Sunday on this radio station. And Ruth Wilson is with us, descendant of formerly enslaved people who had been denied access to this property once they had been titled. Ruth, was the Center for Public Integrity able to tell you exactly what piece of land your ancestor was given title to?
I don't remember seeing that. I shared with them, I didn't know anything about the land on Sapelo Island, except that in Ancestry.com, there were pictures of my great-grandparents' graves, and I contacted the folk and said, are you a relative? And they were not. They were from the University of South Carolina. They were also doing research about 40 acres and a mule, and I didn't even catch it then. I read it and I said, oh, they worked it for about a year and a half and then they had to go. I didn't know they had actually been kicked off the land. The land had been rescinded. I didn't know that. And it was Alexia who clued me in on what the real deal was.
Alexia?
Yeah, so Ruth hadn't seen the land title until we showed it to her. But what's really interesting is that also because her great-great-grandfather, Fergus Wilson, he got a land title, but so did two of his sons because he had many sons and they were grown by the time this happened. So they also got land on Sapelo Island, which was where they were they weren't enslaved. They may have been born there, but it was owned, but they were enslaved by the Spalding family who had a big sugar cane plantation.
Yeah. There.
And I know eventually your great-grandfather was sold to like a railway company and was working there, but that's probably what they knew as like, that's where they were born. So, So three people in her family who got land titled and then lost it.
I mentioned that a lot of the land that was part of this today is worth millions of dollars. And it is, many of the pieces of land are in high dollar neighborhoods in those areas. Do we know what was on that island? What's on that island today, Sapelo Island?
Sapelo Island has not been very developed. I didn't get a chance to go there. It's actually hard to access. My understanding is that there is a community, a Gullah Geechee community of formerly enslaved descendants of people who were formerly enslaved that were able to eventually purchase their own land on the island, and they've been able to have a community there. So I'm not sure Sapelo Island, I think they've been able to maintain some of their culture and their land that they bought later, not through 40 acres. But other islands, like we all know, the Sea Islands are like, you know, it's beachfront real estate in many cases,
right,
and is expensive.
April, you spoke with a man named Greg Estevez, who lives in Jacksonville, Florida, and he is the great-great-great-grandson of Jim Hutchinson, who had been given title to a land on Edisto Island in South Carolina in the 1860s. You asked him in the course of that conversation a really important question.
Do descendants of Jim Hutchinson like you, should they get reparations? Should you get reparations? What do you think about that?
So, if you look at the totality, 400 years I've been in this country, the Middle Passage, free labor, Jim Crow, civil rights. Yes, you know, I think there should be some type of reparations. What that is, I can't tell you. And I'm not smart enough to know how to fix it. I don't know how to fix it. You know, even today, a lot of people don't even want to acknowledge. And if they do acknowledge it, they downplay it. Yeah, correct me if I'm wrong.
I'm not arguing with you. No, that's, I think we've experienced some of that just in our conversations with some folks here. Our impression is it's hard for people to look at it straight, and it makes them feel bad. So they'd rather not.
Yeah. You can turn it off.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
Why did he ask you to turn off the recorder?
It was an emotional moment, and he started to cry. And so, you know, we turned off the mic. But I think at this point, we had spent the weekend with Greg. We had gone over a lot of history, a lot of difficult history, and it just kind of caught up with him, and he just needed a moment to catch up with himself.
The topic of reparations for slavery is one that continually comes up periodically in our conversations in 21st century America and back in the 20th century as well, and probably the 19th too. One of the arguments against reparations, of course, is that no people alive today owned individuals as enslaved people, and no people alive today have been enslaved. But we know that the folks who were enslaved, their descendants went through incredibly ugly periods from the end of Reconstruction onward to the present day through Jim Crow, unequal treatment that Ruth spoke about, redlining in neighborhoods, part of which was addressed by the civil rights movement and the civil rights policies that were passed by the Lyndon Johnson administration. But a lot of black people have been held back. They were unable to build generational wealth, which could have started with this 40 acres program, which was the intent of it, in fact, in the beginning. Given the research, Alexia, that you have done, the property titles that you uncovered, the fact that these titles were rescinded and a promise was broken, is this an instance of where reparations are clearly in order?
Yeah, you know, we spoke to a lot of people who had mixed reactions, like even descendants. Some were like, yeah, we deserve reparations for this. Others were like, well, my ancestors deserved compensation for this, but I don't think I deserve it. So we just heard so many different reactions to it. I don't think I have the answer, but I do think it definitely adds legitimacy to the claim for reparations, that there were names, people got land titles. It wasn't just a promise. There's like more than 1,000 people that we know were told literally by the federal government, this is your land, you deserve it, you need it. And, you know, even God knows it. That's like one of the quotes.
Well, that is a quote. I want to bring it up right now. Ruth, in Mother Jones Magazine, where articles about this investigation appear, April Alexia and their colleague Pratik Krabala, quote, Union General Rufus Saxton, in a speech he made in 1865 at the Second African Baptist Church in Savannah, he said, quote, the soil is the source of all true prosperity and wealth. No people can be great unless they own soil. You know that. General Sherman knows it. Our Father in Heaven knows it. And now I want to tell you, you may own the soil. That's the end of that quote. That is still true today. And the lack of ownership has been a source of hardship and poverty in the black community, and it continues to be so. In your mind, does this give permission or even call for some sort of compensation, monetary or otherwise, for those whose lineage can be directly tied to these individuals who were made that promise only to have it rescinded?
Of course, something, it has to be corrected. But it has happened over a course of 400 years. Throwing money at it doesn't solve the problem. Opportunities, providing opportunities will, that you would not normally have in life. We have been denied generational wealth because our land was taken away from us. That's in the past. But what could we be if we had kept the land? Where would we be now? So I say give educational opportunities free of charge, free interest for land or housing. Those things that are within our society that have been taken away from us in the past, allow the descendants of these people to experience.
Alexia, and, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go on.
I was going to ask Alexia, if the more, how would you break out the reaction of the people, the descendants of these folks that you spoke with? What do they think should be done?
Everyone had different ideas. So as Ruth, when we interviewed her, as she said now, she, you know, wanting opportunities for people, others saying my ancestors should have been compensated, but I don't believe I need to be compensated. And then April spoke to many people, different reactions. So it was just so many different responses.
April, in an episode, I think it was the first episode, you speak to a man named Jenks. This is a little hard for me to follow, so correct me if I get any of this wrong. A man named Jenks, who is a descendant of Isaac Jenkins Mikkel, or Michael, M-I-K-E-L-L?
Michael.
Michael. He was a slave owner. The man you spoke to, Jenks, is 82 years old, so he comes from a very different generation, and he's conservative. His brother is a liberal who thinks completely differently on this topic. The land he lives on around Edisto Island has been in the family since before the Civil War, and today is worth over $5 million. part of that land had been given to formerly enslaved people, but the family got it back before they had a chance to do anything with that land. And you asked him if he believed descendants of the formerly enslaved who worked that land are warranted some kind of pay or reparations. What was his answer?
No, very, very flatly, absolutely not. He feels like the government is giving away too many things. He says, basically, nobody has given me anything except for this, but he had to work very hard to keep it. And he's quite pained by what he considers the situation that the country is in today.
Well, he said also, anybody in this country who wants to do better has the opportunity to do it. This is a quote. There are many, many, many black folks around this country that have been very, very successful. Now you explain to me why.
Yes. He feels very strongly about that. And it's interesting, obviously, given his lineage and still living on the land now and having a very different opinion, as he said, from his younger brother.
And he added to you in that comment, quote, if we keep giving away stuff, that's all we're going to be able to do because people don't want to work. And quickly added, quote, nobody ever gave me anything. You already mentioned this. Nobody ever gave me anything other than this, the land, but I now have to sweat bullets to keep it. What did he mean by that? Why does he have to sweat bullets to keep it?
Well, it's a lot of land. It's very difficult to maintain. It's thick with brush. His brother told us he has a couple tractors. He still can't keep up with it. You know, it's a jank slice of the plantation is more than 70 acres. And the taxes are high. So that was what he was referring to.
He also asked you to turn the recorder off. And that was pretty much at the end of the interview because talking about this is difficult for a lot of people, including him. What did he say anything after the recorder was turned off?
I can't say what he said.
Okay, because it's
after the recorder was turned off.
Well, I had to ask. So, in General Sherman's original special order, number 15, it states that in the settlements hereafter to be established, no white person, whatever, unless military officers and soldiers detailed for duty, will be permitted to reside, and the sole and exclusive management of affairs will be left to the freed people themselves. Did that add fuel to the fire? Because people were angry about this. Race relations, if it's possible, were worse then than they are today, particularly in the South. There was great resentment. Does the fact that they were going to govern themselves play a role in this as well?
I think to some extent it does. There are letters from the plantation owners to the president saying this 40 acres program is cruelly unjust and really denigrating the enslaved people as folks who couldn't take care of themselves, who you know, had no right to this land. So I think in some level it did make things
worse. And yet, as you point out, for those who did take over this land, at least for the brief time that they had it, many of them thrived. And had very successful crops, et cetera, because they knew how to do that. That's something they'd done their entire lives. As a result of your research, Alexia, the Center for Public Integrity has created a tool called Freedman's Search, on which you can access online at freedman.motherjones.com. It's a tool that you created to allow people to search through some of these 1.8 million records. How can ordinary people do this?
Yeah, you can search your ancestors' names in there if you know it to see if they, you know, because the Freedmen's Bureau had so many records about freed people. You can search bank records, marriage records, school records, hospital records. You can find letters if you know the plantation names where they were enslaved. You can look up the plantations, and there's probably letters from the plantation owners trying to get their land back. And it provides there's so many rich details here. And I also want to say we also publishing all the names that we found with links to the land titles and land registers for people, because we are sure there are descendants. Well, we know there are descendants all over the country, but for surely in North Carolina as well, definitely in the South, people that stayed in the South. So we encourage people to go there. And also Ruth, today we published the profile of Ruth's family and kind of shows you how they did thrive at moments, right? Despite all the odds, like what they were able to accomplish.
And once again, that web address is freedman.com. freedmen.motherjones.com. Ruth, I have 10 seconds. Reparations or not, what do you hope people take from this series?
The course of America. We have a lot to deal with. We're a great country, but we could be so much greater if we dealt with the truth.
Ruth Wilson, descendant of formerly enslaved people, along with April Simpson and Alexia Fernandez Campbell from the Center for Public Integrity.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.